Welcome, listeners, to a new bonus episode of Oh My Word podcast. Today we have a very special guest, and that is Molly Laser. Molly, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. So Molly is an author, but she's also worked as an editor before, and she probably has like a gazillion other things that she's done. But let's get into the basics of how did you get into all this, to become an author, even to become an editor? What came first?
Oh, goodness. Well, I have, I've always been writing from when I was little and, you know, making up stories that my mother would write down to when I wrote my first epic novella of dogs who escaped from their pet shop and got stranded on a deserted island.
Wow.
When I was in sixth grade and found very creative ways of killing them off. that was the best part. I wrote most of a murder mystery in high school that my friends were kind of obsessed with figuring out who the killer was. I knew, but I never actually finished the story. Things just kind of went from there. And in college, I started writing more short stories and what would end up being the first draft of my novel. And since then, I've written and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, and then eventually published my novel, written quite a lot of more short stories, and published a collection of those. Hope to get back to writing again sometime soon, but the pandemic and having 4-year-old twins has kind of thrown a wrench in all of that.
That's exciting.
And, thank you. For editing, during my senior year of college, when I was thinking about what am I going to do after college, I decided I wanted to get an MFA in creative writing, and I applied to 10 different MFA programs, and I got rejected from every single one of them.
Oh, man.
for reasons that at the time were like just deeply upsetting, but now I kind of get it. The piece that I submitted as my sample wasn't what they were looking for, and they didn't necessarily want people straight out of college, et cetera, et cetera. Plus, I applied to 10 of the top 20 programs, and none of them were programs that wanted people who wrote genre fiction, which is the only thing that I really do.
Yeah.
So then I had to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with my life? And I figured I'm really into comic books. I would like to be an editor of comic books. And it turned out that I had connections that I hadn't previously known about to both DC and Marvel. And miraculously, within a few months, I ended up actually being hired at Marvel as an editor. Wow. And I worked there for 4 years.
Wow. Was Marvel your first choice over DC, or that's just the one that worked out?
Yes, I actually interviewed at DC, and I wasn't like devastated when I didn't get the job. I'm a Marvelite. I grew up reading exclusively Marvel comics, and now my superhero comics that I still read, it's pretty much just Marvel.
Were you so excited when they started the whole slate of Marvel films now, or are you at a point now where you're like, not as excited with the films?
I was. They actually proved to be very important to me in my relationship with comic books, because I read comics my dad read them to me when I was very young. Got back into comics after the very first Spider-Man movie came out. I got hired at Marvel right after the second Spider-Man movie came out, and then I left Marvel shortly after the third Spider-Man movie came out.
The original Spider-Man?
The Tobey Maguire one.
Right, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But I wasn't there for the Marvel Cinematic Universe as it is now, but it's appointment movie viewing for me. I think I've only missed one in the theaters.
Oh, wow.
I'm still in it.
Yeah, except when you're watching them, where you're like, oh, that was good. Oh, I see where they went with that. Or sometimes you're like, what did they just do here?
Well, it's funny because some of the things that they've been adapting are stories that actually came out when I was at Marvel. So it's been interesting to see like how they adapted them for film and what's the same and what's different.
Right, right. I guess with fans in general, when it comes to adaptations, you always want to see what you think is the best version of things. But sometimes it's like this person is telling a story and that's their best version of things.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yeah. That's kind of, so why did you end up leaving Marvel for any specific reason? Well, not to get into too many details, or if it was just time for the next thing.
Yeah. There were a lot of factors. I was way overdue for a promotion. I wanted to go back to graduate school and study children's literature. At the time, I thought, well, maybe if I end up liking it, maybe, because I was going back to get an education degree.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, if it turns out that I, you know, like education, I will become a teacher afterwards. I had forgotten at some point that it was like my life goal as I was growing up to be a teacher. And I kind of remembered that at some point while doing my student teaching. I was like, oh yeah, that's what I wanted to do. So I wanted to go back to school. I was overdue for a promotion. And it was just like, I was working, you know, every day, crazy hours. Actually, my acceptance letter to graduate school arrived on a Monday.
Yeah.
And of course, on Friday, I got promoted.
Oh, get out. Oh, man.
Dead serious. So, womp womp.
Yeah.
But I had already committed, so.
Well, I guess if you haven't gone back, then that was the right decision for you.
Yeah, I mean, I've been teaching high school. This is my 12th year teaching high school.
Oh, wow. Wow. When you spoke about how that you're trying to apply for the MFA program, that they didn't want people right out of college. Like, why do they need the gap? Like,
I think at the time I assumed this, and I don't know if it's actually the case, that they wanted somebody with more experience. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I was applying to places like Columbia Johns Hopkins.
Right.
And
right.
I didn't apply to Iowa because I knew I wouldn't get in there. But, like, okay. I didn't get in anywhere. So, but I did end up getting the MFA. And I went to a really good program at Rosemont College, which is right near where I live. I started there in 2011. I finished up the degree in 2015. And it's just a really awesome community that accepted people who wrote, you know, all sorts of stuff.
Wow.
So you just have to find the right place.
Yeah, that's true. Well, but then also you would have had more on your resume. So I wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Yeah. So switching over, you have your two books. So you have one novel that's out on one collection,
mm-hmm.
right? And those are they both YA? The novel's YA. Is the collection also geared for younger readers?
No.
Oh, okay. No. You're like, oh, no. Okay.
So, no, the novel is YA because it has a teenage protagonist.
Right.
The short story collection has protagonists of all ages, from children up to adults, but it's like really dark. That tends to be where my writing goes, especially when it's short. Both the novel and the short story collection are revised and retold fairy tales.
Oh, okay.
And the collection also includes myths and Bible stories. But they tend to veer towards the, like, dark and gory. So I would not necessarily recommend it for particularly young teenagers.
Do you have any of your students that come over to you that, I read your book, and you're cool?
I have a few of them. It's there are copies of it floating around the school building. So.
Oh, okay, cool.
That's been kind of neat.
So why the fairy tale rewrites, especially if you're coming from a superhero background? You didn't write the superhero book. I mean, yes, you can only write the book that's in your brain, but was there a specific reason for the fairy tales?
Well, those were kind of the two things that stuck with me from growing up, were superheroes and fairy tales. I was always really into fairy tales growing up. I spent a lot of time reading, you know, like Grimm's fairy tales. My grandma had a really nice old hardbound collection that I've read multiple times of Grimm and Andersen. I became particularly interested even more with fairy tales when I was in college, and always liked watching fairy tale movies, and I spent a lot of time thinking about them. And I took a course my senior year of college called Feminist Fairy Tales, and I had actually already kind of like started planning my novel at this point, but we read a lot of different versions of fairy tales. The old ones, the kind of bolderized ones,
right.
the the more modern retellings, and we also read a lot of analysis of it, including Bruno Bettelheim's book that I'm completely blanking on the name of right now. But Bruno Bettelheim wrote a psychological interpretation of many different fairy tales. It gets very Freudian, and at a certain point, you're like, no, Bettelheim, you need to stop.
But, too much.
But, yeah, it's too much.
Yeah.
So that all really influenced me, and I like looking at like kind of more the psychological underpinnings of the different fairy tales.
Huh. So, for example, so speaking about Owl Eyes is the young adult novel, and that is a Cinderella retelling. So, in short, what is that about? And then we'll ask about your approach to how you retold that.
Yeah, so Owl Eyes is about Nora, who is a servant in the kitchen house at an estate. She works for the lord and lady of a province called the Runes. And she discovers very early on in the novel that her parents, whom she thought were dead, well, her mom's dead, but her dad, surprise, is alive.
Right.
And is nearby.
Oh.
And she endeavors to figure out who her father must be. I don't want to spoil too much,
yeah.
But it is kind of obvious if you know the Cinderella story who her father is. So the story kind of progresses somewhat along with the regular Cinderella story, but it deals a lot more with Nora's coming of age and figuring out who she is and who she actually wants to be. Because
okay.
Once she finds out her true parentage, she also discovers that, like, she has this whole legacy, both with regards to class, but also with regards to, like, magic,
right,
that has been taken away from her. And so she's trying to figure out why reclaim it if she chooses to, even though there are major risks to reclaiming that magical inheritance.
Yeah. Wow. So If I did strip away anything that you added, would I find the original telling? Well, one of the original tellings there, I would still see it, or is it more kind of inspired by it?
You would. It happens. It kind of all happens in a rush at the end.
Okay.
With the ball and the shoe and
right.
All that jazz.
Yeah, and all that jazz.
So
when you did write this, was it a matter of just, wouldn't it be cool if Cinderella was told a different way? Or it's like, look, this is the Cinderella story, but things need to be changed about it.
It was more the latter there.
Okay.
There are a number of things that really bothered me, like really deeply bothered me about Cinderella.
Yeah.
There are a lot of versions of the story in which her dad is not dead. Like, he's her biological father, and he's around. And like in the Charles Perrault version,
yeah,
which is the French one,
yeah,
he's actively working against her through the course of the story.
Right.
And so I wanted to try to figure out, like, what's up with that? Right? If her dad is not dead, drunk, or otherwise incapacitated, how
right
is it that he's allowing her to be a servant in his household?
Yep, yep.
So that was thing number one. And then the big, thing number two was, how on earth does that shoe only fit her? There
yeah
had to be a reason, because that's not realistic. And
right,
I know it's a fairy tale, but really.
Yeah.
And then the last kind of thing that inspired it was figuring out why the prince. Like, why does she actually want the prince?
Okay.
And why would the prince want her, but more the former?
Right.
Like, what's so great about the prince? Why would she want to be a princess other than that, yeah, it's nice to be a princess?
Right, right.
So just kind of, when I was thinking about the answers to all of that, that led to the spine of the novel.
Well, so, and part of the why the prince or things like that, is part of that just, we have to start developing, give him an actual character and develop the relationship more? Part of that is the actual plot of the novel, of certain things have to fall into place for this to be the decision. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's a mix of both. I actually ended up spending a lot more time with the relationship between Nora, the main character, and her parents.
Right.
That
uh-huh
ended up being actually the major narrative thrust. The prince is like, he's there.
Yeah.
But it was more about like which family she ends up wanting. Does she want the family that's her, like, that's her biological family, or does she want her found family?
Oh, That's yeah. Interesting. I didn't realize, because I also have the Cinderella retelling, and when I first started writing it, it was just because, you know, that was the story that I had, and then I didn't realize how vast the retelling genre was. It's like a really, it's great, because it's always great to know that certain readers are getting what they like, but it's just crazy how big it is. And then I saw, oh, you have one too. Like, hey.
Yeah, I have a whole shelf at home that's just full of retellings of different fairy tales.
Wow. Do you tend to favor certain kinds of retellings over others? Or is it just, it's a retelling, I love it, or I want to see it, you know?
That's a good question. I think my tastes right now are leaning towards the more, like, abstract and poetic type retellings.
Right.
But I've read, you know, a lot of YA retellings of the different stories,
yep.
A lot of, you know, short story retellings. I have a whole bunch of, like, collections of short story retellings by, like, anthologies by multiple authors or collections by single authors.
When you are doing these retellings, either between the anthology that you've got or the standalone, do you think that the story has to have a happily ever after, or do you not necessarily care if they're all happy at the end?
No, it doesn't. No. I'm trying to think, like, if I think about the stuff in my collection, it's definitely, I guess a lot of them do ultimately have happy endings,
right.
But there's, like, a lot of mutilation and cannibalism and, like violence and stuff in between.
Yeah. Well,
so yeah. Like, it's happy, but it's dark getting there. And I actually have a story in mind that, like, whenever I get a chance to write something, the next one I'm going to write just ends with, like, death. So, yeah. No, I tend to go towards the darker elements.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, if you look at some of the original fairy tales, they are pretty dark. Like, they do,
are.
With the cutting off the feet and, like, and Snow White, she has to dance in those shoes until she drops dead. Like, that's...
Yes.
Yeah, you're like, who thought of that? Like, why are they telling this to children?
I know. There's a whole second half to Sleeping Beauty that always gets cut out, which I believe involves, like, the prince's mother or wife getting thrown in a vat of boiling oil after she tries to eat Snow White's children. Like, it's... They're deeply messed up.
Yeah. Well, Well, Sleeping Beauty, I think... No, she gets, like, raped or something, and she wakes up from having kids.
Yeah, in the Italian version, absolutely. She has two children while she's asleep. It's...
Yeah, that's crazy. Who wrote that?
That was the inspiration for one of my short stories where I mashed that up with Rapunzel and thought about, well, if she has a baby while she's asleep in a tower,
right.
And the prince never comes back, that's a girl in a tower that's clearly Rapunzel.
Right, right.
And where do we go from there?
Right.
So.
It's almost like Room, except it's not. Oh, man. Well, what about the way that so many fairy tales have, like, this kind of insta-love, perfect love? Is that something also that you're like, no, out? Or
yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
And that is a major thing that gets dealt with in Owl Eyes. So that's kind of the why the prince.
Right, right.
That whole, like, love at first sight thing, I don't buy it. So, the Owl Eyes definitely explores that.
Right. That was kind of something also when I was doing some of my retellings, that was the biggest thing was, even if they are this, you know, quote unquote love at first sight, that they get married, well, what happens to the relationship afterwards? Like, how can that last? It can't. I don't think it can. These people, well, first of all, I think a lot of them are going to be messed up. Like, if Cinderella is being made a servant in her house, like, that's not a healthy way to grow up. That's just a general idea, especially if, like, you know, that you're saying that you're focusing on the father still being alive and allowing that to happen. That's damaging. And it's not going to be perfect. It can't be perfect after that. So I don't know if that means that we're just thinking about this too much and you're just supposed to let the glow happen. But then again, that story's already, you know, the glow's already been told, that story. That's what you go to Disney for. And that's also when you realize how much Disney cleaned the story up. When you were doing your retelling, because that was something, with all of your retellings, that was something that my editor said to me was, you know, you could do your winks and your nods kind of, but stay away from Disney, because Disney is, you know, its own canon and its own, you're not going to compete with it. So don't try to go in the same, don't try to do too much that's similar to them, because you don't want people starting to think of Disney and you're not going to compete with Disney. Did you even think Disney, or was it just like, no, because we're already going so dark and so otherwise, it wasn't even a concern?
Yeah, Disney never really like came into it for me. I mean, I grew up with some of the Disney movies, but it was primarily like The Little Mermaid and Aladdin and Lion King and like from that era. So I had seen all the other ones, but not for a super long time, like until college, again, where we actually had to watch all of them in our feminist fairy tales class.
Right.
And I mean, I remember watching Sleeping Beauty and watching Prince Philip. Oh God, Prince Philip fight the dragon at the end, and he lost the shield of virtue and then penetrated the dragon with the sword of truth. And I was like, oh, Disney, what are you doing?
when you describe it like that, it just sounds so.
Disney hasn't really come into like my own writing. I think mostly because in between the time when I saw it as a child and when I saw it again in college, I just read so much of the original stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And what is it, just in a few lines, like specifically when you talk about a feminist fairy tale, because it sounds like you are still looking at the original fairy tales and not necessarily some you know, other versions of fairy tales. So what is the focus of a class like that?
Oh, so yeah, it was more analyzing things from a feminist perspective. So we read the original stories, but then we read variations from different countries, and we read modern retellings that took a more feminist spin on it. So we read the entirety of The Bloody Chamber by Angela Carter, for example. Mm-hmm. And so that went along with like Bluebeard, and also there's a Beauty and the Beast version in there, and a bunch of other ones. So modern feminist spins along with the original tales, along with movie versions, different movie versions, and also variants from around the world.
Right. And what are some of the main things that you're seeing from the feminist spins? Is it just a more active, I guess you could say the princess character is a more active character, that she doesn't always necessarily have to settle for the prince, or what are some of the main things that you see there?
Well, it's not always necessarily a princess either. Like, I graduated college a while ago. So
yeah. Well, from what you remember. Yeah.
But I actually have my, my compiled textbook for it on the shelf about 10 feet away from me here. But it was, they weren't all necessarily, princesses, like the Bluebeard variant we read, Bluebeard's Egg by Margaret Atwood, is about a marriage that is falling apart. And so it's not related to, it's related to Bluebeard thematically. It's like, what is he hiding?
Right.
But not in the sense of like being a direct retelling of the fairy tale, but set in modern times.
Uh-huh.
So it's more thematically related.
Right.
A lot of the feminist fairy tales tend to have the princess or female character, using her own power to get what she wants. Things aren't just given to her.
Uh-huh.
She makes her choices.
Right. Okay.
Basically.
It seems like that's the big thing, is being able to make the choices. That's what it's all about, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So when you said, I think we spoke about it before, that you spoke about that you want to get back to writing. Are you thinking of doing more retellings, or you're going to end up in a different direction?
I was actually 30,000 words into a second novel in the beginning of, or at the end of 2019. And then I scrapped it
because
I decided, 30,000 words in, that it was not my story to tell.
Uh-huh.
So that was the end of that. And on the same exact, it was actually New Year's Eve. And on the same exact night, I actually came up with a new idea, which I've like vaguely been formulating in my mind. I would not say it's a retelling. I would say it's more inspired by a fairy tale.
Right.
And then I have a short story that I was inspired by, double casting of Cinderella's prince and the big bad wolf in Into the Woods.
And
I thought I can do something with that.
Oh yeah.
So that's a that's a short story I would like to write. But again, time has been a factor.
Oh yeah. Well, there's never enough time. That's basically,
yeah.
Well, how long, do you know about how long your first novel took you to write?
Well, the first draft was done in, over the course of one summer and approximately one school year. And then I spent the next, 14 years rewriting it.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, and I thought I had it all set. I had just rewritten it from scratch, right before I presented it to my MFA thesis advisor, at the beginning of my thesis process. I thought she was going to say, cool, that's great. Just do some proofreading and you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
She did not. She actually said, no, you need to rewrite this. And I said, but I just rewrote this.
Yeah.
But it turned out she was right. And it was actually, my thesis advisor was, Carmen Maria Machado, who, was just a finalist for the National Book Award.
Wow.
But, she knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
She's right.
She kind of knew what she was talking about.
Yeah. Every single one of her points was valid.
Yeah.
And the ending of the novel had never quite worked for me. Like, there were elements of it that didn't make sense.
Yeah.
And so on the last rewrite, I actually hit that point finally and said,
nice.
I don't know what to do with this. What happens if I have this character just do the opposite of what they've done in every single other draft?
Oh.
And I tried it, and suddenly everything clicked together and it worked.
Oh, that's the best.
So, yeah.
But that also happens with editing in general, where you're so sure that what you've got is right. And then so it says some things and you're like, oh, I don't want to do that. And then you think about it and you're like, well, it is correct. I should probably do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
That's why it's so important, right? So many people are so hesitant to, oh, I don't want to give it to an editor. They're going to change everything. I don't want to give it to this. They're going to, and it's like, they're not going to change it. They're going to help you make it better. At least if they're good.
I always tell people when they look at my stuff, like, I want you to trash this.
Yeah.
I don't want you to tell me it's fine. Like,
yeah.
That's not helpful to me as a writer.
Exactly. Exactly. And I didn't ask you if I should be a writer. I just asked you, does this story make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. Well, I hope your second novel doesn't take you 14 years to write. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I hope so too. I think my kids are going to have to be a little older before I'm able to get around to it. But.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. If you don't want their notations on your computer screen or something. Oh, man. Well, was it... Well, I don't know if you could fully answer this, but having had that gap before going back for the MFA, do you think that gap actually helped you those few years in between? That you went back and you're like, okay, I'm better, like I'm more prepared for what this course can teach me now?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I was actually taking writing classes the entire time
In
between. So I was doing, you know, writer's workshops as at the YMCA and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always still involved in a writing community and still like honing my writing.
Yeah.
But I think that actually the thing that kind of developed my writing the most, and this is kind of random, but it was, I spent a semester with my then boyfriend, now husband, who was getting his MFA at Naropa College out in Colorado. It's this like super hippie school in Boulder.
Yeah.
And people like Allen Ginsberg founded it, and people there write the most bonkers stuff. And I went out there and I was just exposed to so many new and interesting types of writing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, okay, I can try this. I don't know if I can do this, but I'm going to try this. And it really helped me develop my prose style, particularly with my short stories.
Wow.
So that was a big influence on me. And I actually did that right before starting my MFA at Rosemont. I'd already been accepted into the program at Rosemont, and they allowed me to transfer the credit from Naropa over.
That works. Yeah, that's great.
So yeah, that definitely helped me develop my my writing style.
Well, and the stuff that you read these days, are you still reading Marvel Comics and fairy tales, or do you try to read other stuff as well?
So that's funny. I actually just made my big list on Facebook of my 2020 stuff I've read.
Oh.
this year, I've actually read more graphic novels than I have in previous years.
Uh-huh.
But it's been a mix of superhero stuff and non-superhero stuff, like horror comics and science fiction comics for adults. But with my prose reading, this year has also seen a change in my reading tastes. I used to read almost solely young adult stuff, and now I've started reading more books for like written for the adult market. But still, I only read, I was about to say one, but that's actually not true. I actually read three books this year that were not genre fiction. But I prefer, strongly prefer, some sort of genre element, even if it's just like magical realism or general weirdness. I like that better than straight realism.
And what do you think has it also helped you that you've gone over more, that you're splitting more time now between the adult market and the YA market, or is it this is where I'm at now, and who knows where I'm going to be tomorrow?
I think it's more the latter. And I don't know, my longer writing tends to be more YA, and my shorter writing tends to be more adult. It's weird, but that's how it's kind of worked out.
I'm okay, but if it works, it's great. Well, it's funny that it's also interesting you said about the graphic novels, because have you seen a push from when you worked at Marvel to where we are now, that there is a greater push for graphic novels, that they've become more accepted on the reading scene, you know, with that, not just by the quote unquote geeks, you know, but also everyone's reading more graphic novels or
Yeah,
what?
I've definitely seen that. I think I see it particularly in like the students that I teach. I teach high schoolers, so you know, a lot of high schoolers and middle schoolers are reading graphic novels. But I think that particularly as like movies that are based in graphic novels, like not just the superhero ones, there are a ton of movies and TV shows that come from graphic novels. You know, I'm seeing them become more popular overall.
And you think, does that actually help them become bigger or better readers to be reading the graphic novels, or we're just happy that they're reading something?
What, like the students?
Yeah, because a lot of writers and teachers say, well, if the graphic novel is going to be the gateway to reading, then let them read whatever they're going to read. Or are you just seeing that they're just doing that because it's the film out? Or I don't know, you seeing both or
Well, I think it's not just a gateway to reading, it is reading. Because and it requires a very specific set of skills to know how to read a comic book. Like you can't it's not easy necessarily if you have no background in it to just like jump in and read something, particularly some of the like gateway comics for adults like Watchmen. Watchmen is hard. Like comprehension-wise, there's a lot you have to keep track of in Watchmen, but like marrying the text with the pictures when sometimes they don't match together on purpose, and like just knowing like where do I look next? That's a literacy in itself.
That's true.
So yeah.
Well, just to go back a little bit, when as an editor, are you of a comic book or graphic novel, do you look specifically at text, or do you have to look at that marriage between text and images, or they're different editors for both, or what is it?
So it's funny. I actually work for a company as like a part-time job called Comics Experience, where I still edit comic book scripts now, of people who want to break into the comic book industry. And so I'll look at their script and I will comment not just on the story itself, but also on what they're suggesting for the visual storytelling. So you have too many panels on this page. You might want to think about cutting X out. This seems redundant. I'm not sure you need these panels. Maybe you could show this, that, and the other. So there's a lot of different things to consider when you're a writer for a comic book script. But then with the editing work I did at Marvel, it wasn't just working on the script. So we did story edits on the script, and then we managed the flow of the art from the penciler to the inker if they weren't the same person, got files, sent them to the colorer and the letterer, and then made notes on those. I spent a lot of time doing color edits. Just, sending them back to the like I wasn't doing the coloring edits myself, but like, sending a list, and then copy editing on the lettering, making sure everything looks right when it's composited together. So it's basically seeing the whole thing off from the idea form to the printed page.
You ever have times where you get an image and you're just like, this does not work. Like, this scene needs to be redrawn. You ever have to deal with stuff like that?
You know, it's happened.
Yeah.
Some artists will send in thumbnails of like, this is what I'm envisioning the page to look like. It's a very rough sketch.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes we would give notes on the thumbnails. But, I mean, it happened occasionally. It was rare that we'd have to have an artist totally redraw something.
Wow. Well, I guess that's also its own kind of, like, writing a graphic novel versus writing a novel. That's almost like writing a picture book compared to a novel, because you have to be so specific. It's its own skill set. It's its own drawing. Yeah. It's its own artistic and writing skill set. So mm-hmm. if you're going to be good at what you do, you're going to get it, hopefully.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man. Just a quick question on that. What was one of the favorite series or storylines that you worked on at Marvel? Or worked with on Marvel?
Well,
yeah.
I when I was growing up, I was reading with my dad Fantastic Four and Spider-Man.
Uh-huh.
Those were like my two books. And
yeah.
so I had started, after the first Spider-Man movie came out, I picked up Spider-Man and I also picked up Fantastic Four again. And I really loved the work that Mark Waid and Mike Waringo were doing on that book. And I was fortunate enough to actually come to Marvel while they were still working on the book and be in the office that was doing the book.
Uh-huh.
So I got to work with them on the last half of their run on the title, to work with Mike Waringo before he passed away.
Wow.
And, that was just a huge honor because they're great. They were great people. And, that's, I still think one of the best runs on Fantastic Four, like of all time.
Well, cause,
I also killed Captain America.
Oh,
so that was good too. Yeah, working with Ed Brubaker and Steve Epting on Captain America during and after the Civil War comic book when Captain America got killed. I got a lot of flack for being part of the team that killed Cap. So.
Well, do you still? Do you stick by it? You're like, well, I'm sorry you don't like it, but this is the story. So, or you're like, well, maybe
it
could have been
nicer. I stand by that.
Okay, then here's the other big question, because a Fantastic Four is kind of your thing. The films of Fantastic Four have not been... Like, are you still willing to give them a chance? Or because I think you're making another one, right?
The best Fantastic Four film was the unreleased Roger Corman film. It's a very controversial opinion, but I will stand by that.
Okay.
But, I mean, I think the first movie, it tried.
Yeah.
The second movie made Galactus into a cloud. I don't know what that was about.
Okay.
And I actually did not see the most recent one that came out.
Yeah,
because,
that was, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't need things ruined for me. but they just announced that they're going to do an MCU Fantastic Four movie. So I'm very curious to see... kind of where they take it and what they do with the casting. And I was actually just saying like a couple days ago that if they don't cast somebody like older as Reed Richards,
uh-huh.
They're making a mistake. So,
you're still going to give it a chance. You're still going to give it.
I'll give it a chance. I mean, I think generally the MCU movies have been getting things right.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that this is a chance to get things right.
Do you watch the DC films or you're like, no, Marvel for me?
I've seen Wonder Woman.
Okay.
I saw half of Suicide Squad before we turned it off because it was kind of terrible. I've seen like all three of the Batman movies.
The Christopher Nolan Batman?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But I didn't actually enjoy any of them.
Oh,
I just find
okay.
the DC movies to be very, except for Wonder Woman, which I liked.
Yeah.
I found all the other DC movies to just be very dark, and they're not fun.
But you like dark, yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong, I love dark.
Yeah.
But for my superhero movies, I want them to be fun.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
And, like, even, like, Captain America Winter Soldier, which was pretty messed up, was still fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, I just don't find the DC movies fun. Wonder Woman was fun, though.
Yeah.
I like that. I'm looking forward to the new one.
Yeah, and it's true, there is some sort of, like, I don't know if the right word is thrill about superheroes, that you want that to come across, that, like, he can do that. not just be all, like, dark and serious about whatever they can do. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I guess that makes sense. Well, what about... I don't remember what it's called, but the one with Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, you know what? I actually had never seen that. My husband showed it to me like last year for the first time. I did it. I enjoyed that. Yeah. What's it called?
I know, right? I know he's Mr. Glass. He's
yes, Unbreakable.
Oh, Unbreakable. I think it's called. Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I did enjoy that.
Yeah, because that doesn't have necessarily the campiness of it, but it not a campiness. It doesn't have like the thrill, like I wish the humor, but it's because right. It's not necessarily based on any of these universes. It kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure, like, you know, that's an interesting yeah. take on all this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, cool, that's interesting, cool.
Yeah, and we saw Split, but I haven't seen the third one.
Right, yeah. I heard that, actually didn't see Split either, but I heard the acting, I think everyone was very excited just with the acting of it, more than the set of storytelling. Yeah.
James McAvoy was phenomenal in it.
Well, that's great. Good.
Yeah.
We want to have good impressions of these things.
Yeah.
But yeah. Oh, amazing. Okay, cool. Well, okay, well, watching the time now, let's just wrap it up that I always finish with this fill in the blank of
okay.
I love it when writers, editors, stories, books, publisher, series, whatever you want to fill in the blank. I love it when they do this, and I don't really like it when they do that. So how would you fill in the blanks for those?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay, I love it when books or series surprise me. And keep me up reading despite the fact that I'm ready to fall asleep.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
I don't like it when they do what's expected.
Okay.
But I also don't like it when they go completely off the rails into a direction that's totally unbelievable and not based on anything that's come before.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, what about, because, okay, so I got to ask a follow-up on that. The what's expected, certain books, you're reading them, either because of the genre, well, I guess, like, you are looking for certain things to happen,
mm-hmm.
right? So does that necessarily fall into that category, or just, like, if it's going to happen, at least make it happen in a different kind of way? It's not necessarily the thing that's happening, it's the way you're bringing what's happening about. Does that make sense?
Well, sorry, say it again?
So certain books, I'm trying to think of an example, but so let's say it's a fairy tale retelling, right? And I expect the happily ever after. So is that doing what's expected, or it's like, I don't care if you do the happily ever after, but I want to see you do something different to bring about the happily ever after.
I think it's more, I want to see you do something that makes sense within the world you've created.
Okay. Okay.
Like I won't name the series cause I don't want to badmouth it, but yep. As an example, the series that for a long time contained my favorite book I'd ever read was a trilogy. The author is currently putting out both prequel and sequel trilogy at the same time. And so I'm now five books deep into this thing.
Yeah.
And in the fourth one, I was like super into it. It was great. It was nice to be back within the world that the author had created. And then suddenly at the end, there's like fairies and sea gods and all this magic that felt so anachronistic given the world that the author had created, which had magic. But this stuff did not seem to belong in the world of the previous like 4.5 books.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of disappointing then.
Yeah.
Are you still going to read the other books that are put out from that series? Or are you done?
I'm in too deep. I'm like a third of the way through the fifth one right now. Uh-huh. And my husband keeps saying, if you hate it so much, why are you reading? And I'm like, no, I'm in too deep.
Can't say no.
It's biggest sin right now is that it's just really, really boring, and I'm hoping that maybe in the last 400 pages it'll pick up. But
that's a lot of pages.
Yeah,
keep getting a hope on a lot of pages. Oh yeah. Man. Oh well. Well, I hope it does pick up at least if you're sticking with it. Yeah. Oh man. Well, Molly, thank you so much for joining us. It was great speaking with you.
Yeah, you too.
This was a bonus episode of Oh My Word podcast featuring author Molly Laser. To find out more about Molly and her work, please visit the link in the episode notes. To find out more about Oh My Word Podcast and all the great stuff we're up to, look for us on Instagram at Oh My Word Podcast or visit eltenabell.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Catch you next time.